Accession number 18822, Real One.
George Aitchison, Real One. Where were you born, please?
Shanghai, China.
Which year was this?
1920.
How did you come to be born in China, please?
My father was a headmaster of a secondary school under the Shanghai Municipal Council.
And where did you have your schooling and education?
I was educated in Shanghai up to the age of 15, and then managed to get into St. Albans School in England, followed by 2 years in Cambridge. But of course, at the end of the Tripos in 1941, I was briskly conscripted.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
Yes.
Under what circumstances?
My parents were in Shanghai, and I had difficulty finding anywhere to stay during the vacations, and I just happened to be in the Isle of Wight, where I had a friend with a boat.
And what were your feelings when you heard that Britain was at war again?
Perplexity, sort of selfishly, how will this affect me? And will there be any difficulty changing Chinese money and getting it through to England under wartime conditions?
And was there?
A little, yes. Mainly the Chinese dollar dropped in value over a period of 20 years from 5 shillings to 3 old pence, which meant that my wretched father had to change practically $1,000 to get me 12 quid or something.
And what happened to you in the first 2 years of the war before you were conscripted?
I was up reading Englit, and the summer of 1940 I worked on a forestry camp near Tintern Abbey, and then the university OTC was asked to call back any members not yet conscripted and guard Duxford Aerodrome and also Falmouth Aerodrome. So we lived in tents and were permitted to use the other ranks' ablutions each evening for a sort of shit shave, shampoo and a shower. Otherwise, we were ignored by the RAF, and we were given some World War I Lewis guns, but no ammunition, because they said ammunition was in short supply. But we dug slit trenches on what we hoped were effective crests, and we waited for German paratroopers dressed as nuns but wearing boots, but nobody ever came. And since we were in groups of four, sitting two behind the machine gun with no ammunition, and myself and one other putting non-existent ammunition into imaginary belts, it was perhaps as well they didn't actually turn up. Then the RAF regiment took over, and I drifted down to London and worked in a rest centre at Bethnal Green.
What exactly was a rest centre?
It was Morrison's idea. When the bombs came down, for quite a long time, several weeks, the civilians in London had a hell of a time. You might be bombed out and nobody knew quite where to go. People drifted towards the town hall looking for the city engineer or something, but quite often the staff just said, "Well, I'm sorry, it's 5 o'clock, you better come back tomorrow morning." And so Morrison arranged that the primary schools, good solid buildings in London, built I think in the 19th century, would be turned into rest centres where teams of volunteers would get people who'd been whose places were damaged or were perhaps even injured, and start out by giving them a cup of hot sweet tea, and then asking, "Although your house has been damaged, do you think it's just possible you could stay put? Do you have any children who, for some reason, have come back from evacuation? Or do you have any liabilities? Are you doing a job that simply must be done, and you must stay in London? Or have you relative, friend, or would you agree to a total stranger accepting you as an evacuee?" And we would also see whether they needed superficial wounds and what have you to be dressed. And if it went on too long, everybody was put onto a stretcher with 3 army blankets and left for the night. And then next day we might get them evacuated somewhere safe, or put somewhere where they could continue essential war work or whatever was necessary. So that among the volunteers we had people who were good at first aid, or myself, who could make large gallons of hot sweet tea or whatever and cope with this problem.
And you were an unpaid volunteer?
Oh no, I got paid £3 a week, which was fantastic. We worked from 12 noon to 12 noon, and then had 24 hours off. And I cheated. I found an empty classroom, put a little stretcher there, filled 3 blankets, and in my 24 hours off, I just slept there and used to queue up for meals with the other staff. And nobody really seemed to argue that you shouldn't be here, it's your day off or something. And then I'd go back onto a 24-hour shift. And I never got paid so well in my life, because £3 in 1940 was an enormous sum. And that saved my father thousands of Chinese dollars. So we were grossly overpaid, but I wasn't going to argue. Then, of course, in October, term began, and I went back to Selwyn.
So how long were you doing the job for, approximately?
Not 5 weeks. Not very long. I'd been on a forestry... The Blitz hadn't started. I was on a forestry camp in South Wales, and then at Duxford or Falmouth Aerodrome, and then the rest of the summer until term started at Bethnal Green Rest Centre.
Was there no bombing going on in Bethnal Green when you were there?
Oh, plenty. Oh, yes. The last 5 weeks of the summer vac must have coincided with the height of the Blitz, I think.
And who were your fellow workers at the rest centre?
Very motley crowd. I never found out. I never really made contact with any of them, and they thought I was very odd. And probably I was. You see, if you've been born and brought up abroad, you really have no idea how to behave in England, and you transgress various taboos without knowing it, and so on. And I just wasn't really a agreeable or interesting chap to have around.
Can you give some examples of the type of taboos which you were transgressing?
I would say "pleased to meet you," which was the way the Americans spoke in Shanghai, but of course one should only say "how do you do," and it's small stuff, but just enough to be slightly ill at ease. And of course I could not accept hospitality, because I had no means of giving it back. When my parents sent me from Shanghai in 1985, they hadn't envisage what would happen in 1940. And I had no firm base. I lived out of a rucksack, either in South Wales or Duxford or
Bethnal Green.
And then back to the security, safety and three college meals a day in Selwyn.
How were the people of Bethnal Green standing up morally to the effects of the bombing?
A bit bolshy. A general feeling that local government was not very effective in carrying out swift repairs. You know, the houses not too badly damaged. They just needed the gas reconnected and a pipe inserted for running water, but it was difficult to get that done. I think local government staff had lost chaps to the armed forces, and nobody had really realised that this would be the pattern under a blitz. But they were quite pleased to have a sandwich and a cup of hot sweet tea.
And what was the attitude towards the German enemy at that time?
Well, they used to sing silly songs like "Hitler has only got one ball" and so on. And there really wasn't all that much opportunity to have a long chat with them other than for essentials, because we really had to get rid of them before noon the next day somehow, either living somewhere else doing a central job or on a bus towards St. Pancras Station, towards some area where a wretched housing chap would have to find them accommodation as evacuees.
And did any bombs fall near you, near your premises?
Yes, they were really quite loud. But nothing actually hit the school. As it happened, nothing hit the school.
Do you remember where it was, the street?
No. I couldn't find it. I have, over the years, coming from Shanghai, no firm base during vacations. The war, mostly in Burma, 20 years in Nigeria after the war, and a hurried exit from Nigeria after the first revolutionary military coup in 1967, and I've lost diaries, records, photographs. Apparently there's a lot.
Now, when you returned to Cambridge in the October, what was Cambridge like during the Blitz?
Virtually untouched. Of all places, Fenners was one of the places hit. And there were great shrapnel marks on the walls around the cricket ground. We used to speculate and said, was it a friendly German who'd perhaps been over to Oxbridge and had deliberately aimed at Fenners so that he wouldn't do any damage to any of the colleges? But of course, that in the dark, it was most unlikely that the chap knew what he was doing. He just it was one of we had what were called the Baedeker raids. I think they went around bombing places of historic interest. Not very seriously. Not like, say, Coventry.
So did the war touch you very much or at all in Cambridge in 40-41?
Yes. Rationing. We had to give up everything, and the college wasn't a good college for cooking. And up till 39, we had to, in Selwyn, attend four chapels a week wearing a white surplice. That was laid down by the founder, Bishop George Augustus Selwyn. But eventually that was rescinded. And then we were all told to double up and leave alternate staircases free. And the RAF came in and they were given their basic initial training in Hill College. This may have happened in other colleges as well, for all I know. But it was extraordinary. The basic training seemed to be quite unrealistic. They would march up and down on the gravel round the quad, and then the men in charge would shout, "Halt! 2, 3! And at that they saluted and brought their arms down and turned about and marched back. And they could keep that up for an hour. Perhaps a certain amount of basic drill was necessary for anybody. I think they stayed about 6 weeks.
Were your studies at all affected?
Yeah. We had every Wednesday, we had to go down to the Royal Ground, and there would be some massive organisation for the OTC. The training was really quite good. I was surprised. We got some very good people, and it helped me enormously when I went to Octu later, because the standards at Octu, by the time I got there, were quite high. They'd commissioned far too many people in 1940, and they're not anxious to pass everybody by the time I reached Octu. And I was very glad of the quality of training I received at Cambridge, not only in the long vac, but every Wednesday throughout the term for 2 years.
What type of things did you learn in the training?
Junior leadership, running a section. Now you press me. Nothing comes readily to mind. By the end of it, I was able to drill 30 men really quite effectively, and knew that a very short haircut and a cake of soap were essential if you were to find favour. But I'm trying to think. Well, we had section and platoon training and weapon training, the old SMLE rifle, and we weren't allowed brand guns because ammunition was so short. In fact, at the time, we only had the rather very much inferior French VB gun.
What were the qualities impressed on you in the junior leadership instruction?
Reliability, the sense to keep men above you informed the whole bloody time. How to spot the skivers, the stragglers, the difficult ones, and watch out for that factor, and try and get your section or platoon smart and soldierly. I was once sharply criticised for failing to bring all my men to attention as an officer approached.
Can you tell me about actually joining the army, please?
Yes, I finished Tripos Part 1 on the Saturday, and next day I caught a train to Bulford Barracks, and Bulford Barracks was an Octu with an absolutely first-class regular guards colonel in charge. He was really quite brilliant, I was slightly shaken as we stood in a line waiting for the regimental sergeant major to take our details. A couple of men were being sharply dressed down for failing to move at the double and failing to salute at the double for 6 paces at the sight of an officer. The discipline there was real strict guards discipline. The drill, everything. And then word was whispered back down this line of civilians, "Call the RSM, sir." I'm sorry, it probably wasn't loud enough. "Call the RSM, sir." Which is a very good piece of advice. It never occurred to me to call an other rank, sir. To me, an RSM would be another rank. there we trained for 18 weeks and got, at one point, the whole octu was closed and we were sent to Dunbar, where another octu was opened. And then we were in extraordinary company. A quite unusual experiment that didn't really succeed and was never tried again. One third of the company's entry, we were about less than over 100 strong, 35, one third were university people like me. One third were regular old sweats who'd all seen service on the Northwest frontier. And one third were just a militia's army, you know, off the streets, and had managed to work their way through the ranks and show that they justified octu training, and a couple of chaps who had fought in the Spanish Civil War. But this didn't shake down. I found that the people who took charge were the old sweats who'd served on the frontier, and the rest of us just fitted in as best we could, and then would terribly, if you had dirty fingernails, or one chap was found stubbing out his cigarette and putting the stub behind his ear, you were immediately told, report to company office, less white bands. The white band was your cadet status, and you were given a third class ticket back to your unit and RTU'd. And they RTU'd 35 of us. Some chaps who really weren't good enough got through, I don't quite know how. One chap blatantly arse crawling the platoon sergeant. Some chaps who were quite good were RTU'd. And we, on an inside scale of values, really knew more about our fellow cadets than the staff did. But the real trouble was this composite company of regular NCOs, university entry, and whole militia's army, was that the staff didn't like it. When we were commissioned, there was a complete entry of public school and university, and they all arrived looking very well dressed, in taxis from the station, and behaved as you might expect sixth formers and university entry to behave. There's some indefinable way you could sort of recognize that. And I remember the staff sergeant in charge of weapon training said, "Ah, this is a bit more like." With them, they knew when to push, when they would say, shout out, "You, sir, are a bloody fool, sir," and so on, or something like that, or, "You, sir, are an idle, incompetent cadet, sir." But there was some kind of rapport between the regular octu staff and that kind of entry, which was not available to us, and we lost 35 men, mainly because of friction with the staff and so on. Anyway, we were commissioned, and I was sent all the way down to a transit camp in Marybourne from Dunbar, and then sent all the way back up to a troop ship on the Clyde, and 60 days later landed at Bombay and was pushed out to the 1st 4th Gurkhas.
What was the troopship voyage like?
There were 3,000 men aboard and 88 QAs. One or two of the QAs of singular charm and rare beauty, but I never got near. There were some very smooth chaps who appropriated them. The matron in charge was an old dragon, and of course, there was absolutely no question that any of the 3,000 men aboard would leap into bed with one of her QAs. But they did find a way of cheating. They used to go into the bathroom, turn on the tap, turn on a bath, but under their bath towel there was a lilo, which they would skillfully blow up, and then along, looking as though she's just coming in for a bath, would come one of the girls. So I don't think the matron ever found out. And when we reached Durban, after 6 weeks aboard, we were all allowed ashore, a trifle bored, and most of the convoy of 70 ships, most of the convoy got absolutely blind drunk, and every night there were about 400 chaps, absolutely stone cold, dragged by the military police into groups of 10, with fed up adjutants and orderly sergeants wandering around saying, it's one of ours, and dragging him away until he sobered up. And then I don't know what punishment they could give a chap aboard a ship, because the conditions on, say, E deck were so bad that I found it extraordinary. As a second lieutenant, I had a single cabin, but an extra bunk had been put in, and I had to share it with somebody else. And in the dining room and everywhere else, I was treated like a first-class passenger. And the cadets and the other ranks, there was a complete artillery brigade, as I could tell, were below decks as far down as E deck, under, I thought, dreadful conditions. Noisy and crowded. They all had hammocks. And there were so many of them, they could only be allowed out at certain times on deck, certain times a day. But we were allowed on deck or anywhere the whole time. At meals, I couldn't have faulted the kitchen or the staff if I'd paid for a first class ticket. It took us 6 weeks to reach Durban, because I found out, it was difficult to find out what was going on. But I found out that at one point we were only 30 miles from the east coast of America, or so I was told. Simply avoiding submarine packs and so on. Oh, we did have a couple of nights in Freetown, but it was stinking hot and there was no leave, and enterprising Africans sold us fruit which we hadn't seen, mangoes and so on, and we all got diarrhea. But there were we weren't allowed ashore. And then Durban, and then Bombay. I met a chap who was streetwise, who said, "We're all entitled to stay at this Taj Mahal, provided we pay 7 shillings and 6 pence, which I think was 5 rupees, something like that, towards the cost of the." So I had one night in